Dow Now for the Dow.
Are we done yet with Wall Street's slump?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moen in for Steve Chiotakis. Good day to you. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, thank goodness, June 10th.
Happy Friday. Coming up, what'll it take to snap the Dow's long losing streak?
And we'll look at how the regional economy figures into Turkey's elections this weekend.
Also, Richard Dreyfuss does a dramatic reading you will not want to miss.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
It's shaping up to be the sixth losing week in a row for Wall Street. Investors were mostly happy with a small uptick yesterday, but the six down days that preceded it were the worst negative stretch for the stock market in 2 years. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large with CBS Money Watch. She joins us now, as she does every Friday, today from San Francisco. Good day, Jill.
Good morning.
I'm hoping you can put this in perspective for us. Statistically, yes, the worst stretch in 2 years. But take a look back to 2009. We're talking drops in the hundreds of points. So is this slump really all that bad?
Oh, listen, the economy is in much better shape. Corporations are making solid profits. And while job creation is slowing right now, in 2009, remember, the economy averaged job losses of more than 700,000 per month in the first quarter. That was followed by losses of about 400,000 in the second quarter. And look, the Dow is only down 5.4% from the 2011 high. So let's calm down.
Mm-hmm. And with this latest market volatility, how much of a setback might this be for savings and 401k plans, for example?
Well, I mean, a little bit, but 401k dollar values are at 12-year highs at about a 75,000, according to Fidelity. You know, we just know that we're not saving enough. We only have about half of the country saving enough for retirement. The other half saving less than 25,000, Bob.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Now let's get to trade. The government said this morning the prices of the things we import from other countries edged up 0.2% in May, and the prices of the things we export rose by the same amount. Analysts say this supports the view of some economists, including Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, that inflation is so far not a very big problem. We're going to truth squad this now with Chris Lowe. He's chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us from New York, as he is every Friday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Chris, first of all, a lot of people are going to hear inflation isn't a problem, and they're going to say, tell that to my food and gas bill. Why is there such a difference between the official numbers and what we're actually paying for staple items?
Yeah, and thanks, by the way, for making me part of the truth squad this morning. look, you know, only a 0.2 increase in April, which is the smallest increase in 8 months, but therein lies the problem. Import prices are up 12.5% in the last year. I don't think anyone would argue that that's not inflation.
Well, a lot of people, when we talk about imports and exports, and specifically exports, they look and say, you know what? The U.S. has a weak dollar right now. That could be a good thing for our exports as we try to use our cheap currency as a selling point for our exports to other countries. Is that working, do you think?
Well, look, it definitely is a good thing for exports. The problem is when you're in a consumer society, which the U.S. certainly is, a weak currency is a double-edged sword, and we see it in inflation. We also did benefit from better exports. We had, in fact, better than expected trade numbers reported just yesterday for April.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Now to the troubled housing market. The White House says three big banks are not doing enough to help struggling homeowners keep up with mortgage payments. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo will lose millions of dollars from a federal mortgage modification program that's been one of the Obama administration's main tools in helping the housing market.
Let's get the details now from Marketplace's Amy Scott. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, why are these banks being singled out by the White House?
Well, the Treasury Department says they haven't been doing a good enough job of things like finding homeowners who might qualify for a modification and communicating with those borrowers. The federal government pays these banks an incentive to participate in the program. Last month, B of A, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo got about $24 million total. Banks dispute the findings, but they're not going to get any more money until they make some changes. And some analysts are suggesting suggesting they might pull out of the program altogether.
And if they do that, how effective can these modification programs, which are meant to keep people in their homes, really be?
Well, the efforts haven't helped nearly as many people as the Obama administration had hoped. I spoke earlier with Chris Mayer, who teaches real estate at Columbia University. He says there aren't that many people left who could really benefit from a modification.
There are, you know, a couple million loans that have not been making their payments for the better part of 2 years. At this point, those need to be foreclosed.
Mayer has another idea to jumpstart the housing market, which would be to take advantage of these low interest rates we're seeing of about 4.5% to help more people refinance who don't qualify right now. But, you know, there's just not a lot of political will to spend more taxpayer money bailing out the housing market.
Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us live. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Sharp disagreement in Europe over how to resolve the debt crisis in Greece has been pulling the euro lower.
And it's no downward-facing dog for yoga retailer Lululemon, Bob.
Easy for you to say.
The company says its first quarter profit jumped by more than 50% to $33 million.
We've got more numbers anytime at marketplace.org.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In the Plex by Stephen Levy or The New Frugality by Chris Farrell, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective, the Japanese earthquake and tsunami happened 3 months ago tomorrow, and Toyota said this morning it now expects a more than 30% drop in this year's profit as a result of the disaster. Meanwhile, the cleanup goes on in the cities and towns that were devastated, as the BBC's Roland Burke reports.
The tsunami wave flattened much of this small town on the northeast coast of Japan. Amazingly, some houses are still standing. You can see from the tide mark that the wave reached above the height of a person's head, bringing with it tons of mud, which volunteers are clearing out with spades.
When I came here, I was shocked. I couldn't say anything when I first saw this scene.
Tetsuo Kimura works for GEN, Japan Emergency NGO, which is working to clean up thousands of houses it thinks could still be habitable.
The wreckage has been gathered up into huge piles. I'm standing next to one now. It's the same height as a 3- or 4-story building. A jumble of splintered wood, clothes, metal, someone's teddy bear over there. And it stretches 100 metres and more in both directions. The question now is what to do with it.
Hideyuki Katsumata's company runs Ishinomaki's garbage trucks. He's brought me to the dump that's been set up high in a valley just inland.
How much wreckage is there?
It's approximately 350,000 tons.
350,000 tons?
The tsunami has left Katsumata's team with the equivalent of an entire century's worth of household rubbish to clear, and they're struggling to find space for it in the landfills created for the debris.
We thought that was enough for 1 year, but we started before 1 month and a half, or now it's full.
So you filled up a place you thought would last for a year in a month and a half?
Yes.
New landfill sites will have to be found. The government is urging local authorities to sort the waste so as much as possible can be recycled. But clearing out these mountains of debris will take years. In Japan, I'm the BBC's Roland Burke for Marketplace.
In Europe this week, the mobile phone company Ericsson rolled out its new plan to allow people to make payments by mobile phone. Similar early-stage tests are going on in the U.S., but the mobile payments aren't new in East Africa, where a few people outside major towns have access to traditional bank accounts, so they've been making payments through their phones for years. The BBC's Anna Cavell reports from Uganda.
On the Uganda street, it's as easy and quick to receive money as it is to receive a text message. A registered user can just take their mobile phone to one of the phone company's storefronts, show the message, pay a small fee, and then receive that money in cash. It's now commonplace for people to pay for all sorts of things using their mobile phones, even utility bills and school fees. Kenneth Munyi at Kampala's Protea Hotel used to have to pay his staff in cash.
We had a lot of concern about staff queuing in the office asking for getting paid.
And we discover that it's a nice method of paying people because they won't actually have to come to the office to get paid.
Before mobile money, if somebody wanted to send cash back to their village, they'd have to carry or ship it back. But since so many people in East Africa now have mobile phones, it's possible to send cash around with much less risk of theft. In Kampala, Uganda, I'm the BBC's Anna Cavell for Marketplace.
Turkey goes to the polls this weekend, and Sunday's election will be watched closely as the first democratic election in the region since the Arab Spring began. The ruling party, which has been in power for almost a decade, is widely expected to win because of one key factor, the economy. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports from Istanbul.
Here on the streets of Istanbul, you could easily think that Turkish politicians aren't engaged in a battle of ideologies, but in a battle of the bands. Hey, hey. Ahmet Gümüş, who's a campaign volunteer, is here to drum up votes for the ruling AKP party. He flips through campaign brochures, showing me what the party's accomplished. He says, we've built roads, inflation is down, Europe and the Middle East are investing here. Turkey's economy is growing at 9%, which is roughly the same rate as China. Inflation is under control. Ordinary Turks, who once had to get around the country by bus, can now afford to fly from one of the dozen or so new airports that have been built. Ali Çarkoğlu is a political scientist at Koç University in Istanbul.
And almost everywhere you can take a plane ticket and fly in within an hour or so. And when you get on a plane, you see that, you know, quite modest background Turkish peasants are also using the plane.
And the AKP is quick to take credit. Its election ads boast of how much things like education and healthcare have improved. As some voters are afraid the party wants to lead the country in a more Islamic and less secular direction. But Çarkoğlu says economically, you can't deny that it's delivered the goods.
On the economic front, I can think of no significant group, basically, who would make a time-wise comparison and say, I'm worse off.
But Turkey has been through a lot of boom and bust cycles in the past, and many people say it's due for a downturn. Here in Istanbul, though, and in much of the rest of the country, voters seem to be buying the party's economic pitch. Bilal Deniz owns a jewelry store. He never really bothered to vote before because he thought all politicians were corrupt. But he says after the last 8 years, you can't deny the current government has been good for Turkey's economy and good for him. So on Sunday, he'll vote for the first time for the AKP. In Istanbul, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The tiny Gulf state of Bahrain today confirmed that it will not host a major international auto race this year. The Formula One race was first canceled in March because of civil unrest related to the Arab Spring. But last week, the race was surprisingly rescheduled for the fall, only to be canceled again today, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Last week's decision to reschedule the Grand Prix race was made by the Formula One organisers, but the teams taking part in the race rebelled. They said it should not go ahead, citing logistical and insurance issues. However, says Jonathan Reynolds, editor of Formula One Racing magazine, the heavily sponsored teams are more likely worried about commercial damage.
I think it's just important for any global sport these days, with a huge number of sponsors and corporations attached to it, like Formula One, that you make sure that you get your image right. And going to a country like Bahrain is not very good for Formula One's image.
Bahrain has now accepted the decision to cancel the race, but this will be a big financial blow. The event was expected to inject $500 million into the Bahraini economy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Got a tip for you, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Go ahead and suck up to the boss. It's good for you.
It really is,
yes. According to a newly published study, fawning over the boss isn't just an effective way to climb the career ladder, as you'd of course imagine.
Yeah.
It can also help you stay healthy.
Huh.
The reason is simple. According to the Journal of Management Studies, employees who ingratiate themselves with the boss and with their coworkers, for that matter, stress out less about their job security. That means you're not going to be so tired or depressed at work. So if that's the case,
yep,
to all our bosses here at Marketplace,
here we go.
We dedicate our closing theme.
And I don't say this to everybody. You look marvelous.
The credit for this goes to Billy Crystal, of course.
And this is from my heart, which is deep inside my body. It's better to look good than to feel good. Get down!
A number of cities around the country will hold their gay pride events this weekend, and along with the events come lucrative corporate sponsorship opportunities. But as Sally Herships reports, this year sponsors aren't just donating to gay pride, they're selling it.
Crate & Barrel's CB2 division has already sold out of the $20 poster it made for Gay Pride Month. Marta Calle is brand director of CB2.
Really, it's not driving any sales for us. We're selling 1,000 posters. That's not a lot of money based on the kind of volume that we usually drive.
Calle says a lot of CB2's customers and workers are gay, and the company wanted to go beyond the typical sponsorship. So did Old Navy. The retailer is selling a new line of colorful T-shirts bearing the slogan, Love Proudly. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern. He says retailers want to attract gay and lesbian customers.
It's an influential base. It's a group that spends. It's a wonderful group to reach out to.
And for brands, it's all about reaching out.
Because it does say you're inclusive and appreciative of diversity and willing to be open and welcoming.
But Calkins says as more brands align themselves with the gay community, it gets harder to stand out. And it takes new approaches, like selling T-shirts and posters. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Apple is giving a break to magazine and newspaper publishers who want their content read on the iPad or iPhone. Apple said yesterday it won't require those subscriptions to be sold through its App Store. Apple had initially demanded a 30% cut of subscription revenue, plus control of subscriber data, which is a key source of revenue for media companies. But publishers didn't like those terms and conditions.
And while we're on the subject of Apple's terms and conditions, Bob, you know the ones that are like 50 pages long that you have to accept just to buy a song on iTunes?
Always click through those things.
Well, master thespian Richard Dreyfuss has just done a dramatic reading.
By using the Apple software, you are agreeing to be bound by the terms of this license. If you do not agree to the terms of this license, do not use the software.
You know, when he puts it that way, I don't know why I always click accept, Bob. But there's more of those, including some that we decided not to play on the radio at marketplace.org. And finally, Bob, while we're on the subject of the hard-hitting news, to suburban Chicago, where 54-year-old Robert Adams was pretty hungry for a burrito on a visit to the Señor Taco restaurant in Rolling Meadows earlier this week. But he didn't have any cash with him, so he got in line at an ATM, and while he was waiting to use the machine, he noticed a clear plastic bag with $17,000 inside.
Ah, so the burrito was a red herring in this case, right?
That's right. Now, even though he probably could have upgraded to a extra large grande fajita platter with guacamole with all that cash, he turned the money in. Mm. He told the Daily Herald newspaper his parents did not raise him to take cash that wasn't his.
Well, good for him.
That's right.
That's right.
And I hope he got an extra margarita while he was at Señor Taco's. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. In for Steve Tiotakis, this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.